Before we start the show, I wanted to let you know that the UCID Mental Health and Wellbeing Survey is now open for responses. It's one of the largest collaborations that this university has ever seen, designed and run by faculty societies from law, business, science, arts, engineering, design, medicine, and the conservatorium. And your voice will be used to inform UCID's strategy on mental health and wellbeing for years to come. Filling out the survey is really easy. Just go to tinyurl.com/UCIDMH. Thanks. This podcast is made possible by Allens Confidential, the podcast that gives you real insight into what it's like to work at Allens Law. You can listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. From the Sydney University Law Society and sponsored by Allens, this is Footnotes. My name is Jeffrey. This episode is part two of a series about tackling bullying and sexual harassment in the law, recorded earlier this year at an event that Sols hosted in conjunction with the International Bar Association, the IBA. And if you haven't listened to part one, I recommend that you check it out. Highlights include a speech by the Honourable Michael Kirby on how bullying and sexual harassment should be viewed as issues of human rights and dignity. This episode is the panel that was recorded that night. It's got some really good insights on what reforms are being pushed and how young people need to challenge bullying and sexual harassment when it happens to build a better working environment for everyone. And just a note that this episode contains themes which may be distressing for some listeners. If you want to talk to someone, you can utilise the university's free counselling service, talk to your GP, or let Sols know how we can support you. Send an email to president@sols.org.au. The first voice you'll hear on the panel now is Kate Allman. Kate is an awarded journalist and online editor of the Law Society Journal magazine, and she wrote the groundbreaking feature story, Time's Up for the Legal Profession, in December 2018. Then we'll hear from Kate Eastman, senior counsel at New Chambers, who has a human rights, discrimination, employment, and public law practice. She now chairs various committees at the Australian Bar Association, the New South Wales Bar Association, and the Law Council of Australia, working on diversity, inclusion, and equality. And Kieran Pender, a senior legal advisor with the IBA's Legal Policy and Research Unit and author of their report on bullying and sexual harassment in the legal profession, joins the panel as well. All right, here it is.
Tell us a bit about yourself and how you came across this issue.
So I have written about various issues affecting lawyers. I guess my brand is sort of a lot about issues affecting women and equality and especially gender in law. It makes sense to me because I'm a woman, but also, you know, I know a lot of women and young women in law. And it came to me, I had written this story about maternity leave discrimination and women coming back to work and the discrimination they face. And I was attending a few events and started talking to other women about the issues affecting them. And they all came and said to me, why aren't you writing about Me Too in law? Why is every other industry, you know, the Sydney theatre industry, New South Wales Parliament, Hollywood, all having these Me Too revelations when law is, you know, among them just as bad? And my team at LSJ started looking into it, and obviously more and more stories kept coming out. So, well, I first put out a post on LinkedIn, on social media and Twitter, and I, like, my inbox was flooded, all inboxes, all platforms for weeks after that with women who had stories, and even some men who had stories too. So that's, I guess, what I know about this issue. I've spoken to individuals. I've also looked at a lot of the data that Kieran wrote about in this report, and he was kind enough to give me a little exclusive when I was doing this story in December. So I think the data is really important, but I also think it's important to look at the individual situations and the impact that it has on people and their lives, because the people that I spoke to, majority had left their workplace, the victims, and the harassers or the bullies still worked at their workplaces. I just don't think that that is a trend we would like to continue. So that's what I know.
So I'm going to ask a question to answer your question. So for everybody in this room, assuming that you finish your law degree and you're going to start a job in law or accounting or management consultancy or whatever it might be, how many people in this room think that in the first 3 years of practice you'll be sexually harassed?
Okay. All the girls.
Right, not one man. How many of you think that in the first 3 years of practice you will know someone who's been sexually harassed? Okay, so you see the difference there. When I was starting law school in 1985, and if somebody had asked me that question and the women that I was with at law school then, none of us would have raised our hands. It was incomprehensible to us as women studying law in the mid-1980s and starting our legal practice in the late 1980s that we would be sexually harassed. It never occurred to us that that would even happen, and it did. And so I now look at the stats that Kieran's collected, and I look at the stats that we've collected at the Law Council in a big survey we did about 5 years ago, and 80% of all women barristers report that in the past 5 years of their practice they have been bullied, and 55% of all women barristers have been sexually harassed. So that's what makes me really interested in the topic at the present point in time. But my last year at university was to do some work with the Human Rights Commission, and I did this project with Quentin Bryce, which was called the SHOUT campaign, sexual harassment, SH, out. And our focus then was on young women, particularly in retail and in small business, who were sexually harassed, because that sort of seemed to sort of be where the demographic was. And for me, these were women about the same age as me. And it made me think that if the impact of sexual harassment on your ability to just go to work might be an impediment to women in professional working environments, this is something that I was interested in. So my practice in law is employment law, discrimination, human rights. And so over the years, I think I've probably done thousands and thousands of sexual harassment cases. So this is sort of my area of practice. And in some ways, I'm so delighted the issue's been talked about now, but I've been doing this for 30 years. 30 years of watching the trends in sexual harassment and have been involved in various cases. So that's my answer to your question, but I wanted to ask the question first so you got a sense of how I got my interest.
I arrived at the IBA 2 years ago and was given this project, and here we are. I mean, I have a background in employment law too, so it wasn't entirely out of the blue, but as she was saying to some of the people earlier, when I arrived at the IBA, we'd just done this report called Women in Commercial Legal Practice, and I was given the report on my second day and said, this is yours now to champion, and the next step is a sexual harassment and bullying specific survey. And I looked at the report and I thought, I'm not a woman and I'm no longer in commercial legal practice. And at first I wasn't sure if I was entirely comfortable sort of championing this report. And then I read the report and it made the very salient point that these aren't women's issues. These are issues that all of us need to engage with, and all of us are affected by, directly or indirectly. And then I read a really good short book called We Should All Be Feminists by a Nigerian writer, and very quickly realised that, you know, the point that was being made by the predecessor report to us too was that this is something we all need to engage in. And so then I wrote the report.
Thank you very much. So this is a question from the FIRD, which is, to what extent is this an endemic legal issue in the
So I would sort of perhaps frame the question this way. Is sexual harassment prevalent in the legal profession? The answer is yes. The areas are particular pockets and often particular circumstances. So if I look at the legal profession as a whole, for the most part, you're generally going to be safe going to work in an office environment. But sometimes when the boundaries in relationships become blurred, so the after-hour activities, too much alcohol, misuse of power, that's where sexual harassment can arise. And the other thing too, I think, for the legal profession, often there's a very distinct overlap between bullying and sexual harassment. So sexist comments can have a sexual element to it, and that makes it sexual harassment. But a simple straight out sexist comment is not sexual harassment. So in that sense, I think it's endemic because it's part of the culture, and often in a very adversarial culture, you look for weakness in your opponent, and sometimes gender's perceived as the weak spot. And so the language will often be gendered language, and that's what creates that sort of blurry line to what will be sexual harassment. You might have a different view from the survey.
I'm often asked, how the legal profession compares to other professions. The report touches on some comparative literature, making direct comparisons hard because surveys often use different methodologies, so direct comparison isn't possible. But my response to that question is, it doesn't really matter. Yes, there are societal underpinnings to these challenges that we face, but the legal profession has particular reason to urgently address these issues. One, we have good character obligations. Very few other professions have, you know, regulatory obligations to not be dickheads, to put it bluntly. And as the report points out in the foreword by our president, that's been an obligation that's been around for two millennia. So, you know, we really need to get it right. And we obviously have ethical obligations to address these, but then also it's the legal profession advising other sectors on how to deal with these issues. Julie Gillard says in her comment at the beginning of the report, it's our role to drive that broader societal change and address those underlying factors that contribute to the prevalence of this conduct. And if we have it rife within the profession, as the numbers seem to indicate, then we're just hypocrites.
I'll just add, whether it's endemic to a profession, I don't think it is. I think it's endemic to humans. Like, hand up if you have not been bullied or sexually harassed. Right? So there are things in law that I think lend themselves environment factors that make bullying and harassment more common. So I think of like long hours where people are undersleeping, they're stressed out, there's a lot of deadlines, they often sacrifice other parts of their life, so there's less balance in a lot of legal workplaces. There's a real structural hierarchy in law firms particularly. So there's, you know, partner, senior associate, manager, graduate, clerk. So there's this real power imbalance that makes it easier for sort of people at the top to get away with bad behavior. So I don't think it's necessarily about lawyers or law. It's the environmental factors. And you can control those things. You can take care of your mental health and you can sort of keep yourself healthy in other ways and balance, which will, I think, help protect yourself and also eliminate eventually.
Yeah, I think this leads quite well to some of these next questions that we have here, which is in relation to how this impacts students specifically. So we have one here, which is, as a young female law student, statistics such as these make me concerned about entering the legal profession. Have there been any noteworthy improvements?
There are improvements. So one very significant improvement in the profession is with solicitors. So the majority of solicitors in New South Wales are women, although the majority of the women are young women. And so once you start to change that dynamic where you have more women in the workplace, that has an impact on the opportunity for sexual harassment. And it also sets better standards in terms of human relations. So that is a great improvement. I think the other thing is that women are now prepared to make complaints. Not always, but they're prepared to do something. And that's a real change in the last 5 years. Up till 2014, say if I just use the bar, we had no woman who reported to a survey that she'd been sexually harassed saying that she'd made a formal complaint. It just didn't happen. So we got to 2014 and no one would admit that they'd made a complaint. But since then, women have been prepared to say, if I can't speak up about it as a lawyer, and if I can't do anything about it as a lawyer, how can you expect other people to do it? So I've seen a lot of women now being prepared to call out that behaviour. They've been prepared to trust the other women who they work with to talk about sexual harassment. And I think at a professional conduct level, what we've seen is an increase in sexual harassment and inappropriate sexual behaviours in the workplace now being the subject of professional conduct complaints. So that's really sort of starting to bite. So I do think that there has been some improvements. I'm very positive about the law as a good working environment. So I don't want to sort of give you this terrible impression that, you know, the day one, there was some sort of person jumping out of a cupboard trying to sexually harass you. That's
Yeah, I also think that the Me Too movement has really helped that. There's so much more talk about the issue, this report. We're having an event now at law school. Previously, no one, like when I was at law school, no one told me about sexual harassment or talked about it. So even that awareness shows that people are taking it seriously. And increasingly, clients are voting with their feet. And I just heard from a large consulting firm that they fired one of their clients because of the bullying and harassment that was going on, and they were warned. that firm didn't want to be associated with the business that was allowing harassment and bullying to continue. So in the end, there's going to be a movement to like tighten up, because that's a huge money earner that that firm has just discarded, and that organization is going to need to find a new person to work with. So yeah, I think that it will change.
There's two questions that essentially ask, what is the role, how likely is it that stronger regulatory bodies or stricter legislation will have in promoting and fixing the issue?
So I think there's a simple and a complex answer to that question. The simple answer is we already have the law, and this is a cultural challenge that we face. Australia is one of the more regulated jurisdictions in this regard. We have fairly robust sexual harassment law, although there are some gaps. Barristers who sexually harass each other can't bring proceedings under the Sex Discrimination Act. We have anti-bullying law, one of the very few countries globally that has specific anti-bullying laws. I think, so the Sex Discrimination Commissioner, Kate Jenkins, is currently undertaking her national inquiry. I think it's very likely that will suggest some legislative change, but laws aren't going to fix this. They will contribute to it, but we already have them in place, broadly speaking, and the challenge is the cultural one. I think there is a role for more robust regulators, particularly professional bodies. We're seeing the legal services commissioners and sort of like bodies be more active on this. I think today the Victorian Legal Services Commissioner launched a survey on this to begin some more work in this area. I've got a meeting in 2 weeks with New South Wales Legal Services Commissioner to talk about these issues. They've been doing a lot more. They have a role to play. Bar associations and law societies have a very important role to play. And hopefully all of that together with the workplaces themselves will contribute to the cultural change that we need.
I agree with all of that. There are aspects of the Sex Discrimination Act and the New South Wales Anti-Discrimination Act that outlaw sexual harassment that doesn't cover all types of workplaces. So as you say, for sexual harassment by a barrister to another barrister, that's not unlawful. So there's aspects of the law that need to be improved. So I think that's probably going to be coming something out of the inquiry that Kate Jenkins, the Sex Discrimination Commissioner, is doing. But I think I agree with Kieran, the greater focus on looking at this as professional conduct issues is important. You need to sort of see a sanction with a strong deterrent effect. So the sexual harassment cases that have gone to a tribunal on professional conduct, it's sort of been really a light touch with a feather in terms of the sanctions. So we need to sort of see something serious. No one has ever been struck off in Australia for sexual harassment as a lawyer. But if you were a doctor and you sexually harassed or engaged in inappropriate sexual conduct with a colleague or particularly a patient, and if you do this to a patient, you will be struck off. So we've got a little bit of catching up to do, I think, in terms of other professions.
And I think reporting and sanctions will then have a positive cyclical effect in that more people will feel confident speaking up and that their complaint will be dealt with properly. And so, you know, we need to get the ball rolling. Perhaps it's just started to move, and if we can get it rolling, hopefully that will have a long-term positive effect. Although, you know, change is not inevitable, it's never inevitable.
Yeah, I think this leads to a question, which is, realistically, what do you think is the long-term goal or objective, and how do we go about getting there?
Well, we have legal workplaces where bullying and sexual harassment isn't rife. The huge challenge is there's no end point. So the global head of diversity and inclusion at Clifford Chance, he's a new hire there in London, his name's Tiernan Brady, and he led the marriage equality campaign in Ireland and then in Australia. So he's a social campaigner, he's not a lawyer. And he says to me, challenge here is there's no end point, there's no finish line. With those campaigns, you know, you wanted marriage equality, you worked towards it, you got it. Here, even in a perfect world, there'll be occasional cases of bullying and sexual harassment, because there are always going to be, unfortunately, bad apples as a result of the sort of inherent frailties of the human condition. But all of us have to just continue, you know, once, you know, addressing these structural challenges, and then on a daily level, be good human beings. And yeah, that is a forever aspiration. But, you know, we can be positive, I hope.
Pretty good. I just want to go to work without being bullied or harassed. I just want to do my work.
And so, continuing on from this, what do you think it was in the IBA report, which was engaging younger members of the legal profession, what role specifically do they have to play in driving this objective?
I think that another challenge is in a hierarchical profession such as this. Yes, what role do they have? I think an important role, both in driving reform and putting pressure on firms, on organisations to achieve change. You know, one fairly dramatic illustration of that is that some of the law student societies in the US have boycotted big law firms who have forced arbitration clauses for sexual harassment and other issues, and that quickly got a lot of firms to change their approach. And that's a particular example, but I think all of us can play a role in encouraging our legal workplaces to do more, to do better. If we're persistent about it, that will achieve change. But then, we'll all be leaders of the future. And so if we act in a good manner, if we don't bully and sexually harass now, and hopefully we'll be able to one day lead organisations where that is a key part of our ethos, both individually and collectively.
So I'd like to sort of throw this challenge to law students. And that is, particularly if you participate in a summer clerks program or you do research or intern work with law firms, you never go into an interview without doing some research about that firm. And you've usually got a pretty good idea about how much you'd like to be paid from the person who's going to employ you. And so you're able to ask questions in the context of an interview, but also in the work that you do as a law society student, like running your law societies, is you collect information about these firms. Has your law society asked these large firms, what is your record on sexual harassment? How many complaints have you had of sexual harassment? And what do you do if somebody wants to make a complaint of sexual harassment? I can assure you, particularly with the large commercial law firms, if you ask that question, they will want to try to give you an answer. Because the thing that the large commercial law firms is they want your talent. They want you to come, they want you to work for them, and they go bending over backwards in their summer clerkships and their graduate programs to make their law firm look good. And some of the law firms think, well, if we tell everybody we've got family-friendly policies, then that's going to attract women to our law firms. And what I usually say to young women in that case is, you're just starting your career. You may not have your kids till maybe 5 or 10 years in. So do not choose a law firm based on whether they're family-friendly policies, because that's probably not going to be your immediate concern. But your immediate concern when you start as a summer clerkship, where you're thrown into the deep end in that power relationship, is how do you know that you're going to be safe from sexual harassment? So you guys need to ask these questions of the large law firms, of the community legal centres, of the government departments. Does your firm have an issue with sexual harassment, or what are you doing? Ask them the questions. If they're not going to answer you and tell you, that's not the firm for you. But if they're honest and say, this is what we're doing, then that starts to drive the cultural change. So you have enormous power as law students in selecting where you go and who you're going to work for. Once you're in there, your power might diminish somewhat, but use the power when you have. And I think if ALSA or the law students around the country start to ask those questions, you can start to affect change. So that's my first one. The second one comes from the men in the room, because when I asked the question whether you thought you'd be sexually harassed in the first 3 years of practice, none of you put your hands up, but you all put your hands up when you said you would know someone. So that means you know about it. What are you going to do about it? And so one issue we have in terms of changing the culture is to look at our role as bystanders. And I was very influenced by the work that I've done with the Department of Defence in this area. And I'm a big fan of David Morrison, who said as a leader, I've got to, really do something about this. And you might remember he did the video that went a bit viral, looking down the barrel saying, the standard you walk past is the standard you accept. The Defence Force is hierarchical, we're hierarchical. And so as bystanders, we've got to ask ourselves, do we walk past that standard? Or do we find a way of dealing with it? So I'm not saying like you all get in there and you turn on your male testosterone and you feel that you've got to rescue women. It's not about rescuing women. It's about standing with women. When you see them being sexually harassed, you say, what support do you need at this time? So you support the women, you ask them what they need. And I have seen the most extraordinary courage from younger men who have stood with young women barristers and said, I will go and speak to that QC about the way in which he's treated you. And to really see the courage of those young men being prepared to walk with their women colleagues has made all the difference. And that's changed some little pockets of culture in the legal profession. So those are my two things that I would ask of younger people. Go and test these big law firms and chambers and all of that sort of thing. but for all of us, be aware as bystanders. And if you do it early, it's easy.
I would just add to that that, Jeremy, do you keep contact with former law students, like last year's law students who are now graduates?
Yes.
Because they're your best ears on the ground in terms of how it is actually when you're working in a firm. Your clerkship is going to be a little holiday where they take you along and they, you know, take you to the golf day and they send you on a cruise and they pay for your lunches and you do your 9 to 5. It's very different when you actually get into the firm as a graduate. I'm disappointed to say that a lot of the sources who contacted me for these bullying and harassment stories were former classmates of mine at law school who are now kind of suffering those issues and they're victims and they are really in a tough position because, you know, they're trying to pay their rent, they're trying to go to work and do their work, but they're also being bullied or harassed and it's a terrible place for them mentally, for their mental health. So I reckon get in touch with all the graduates at the big firms especially, but at all the firms, all sizes, and ask them to report back to you and have like your network and set it up because you can gather some informal data. And then, you know, reputations do matter and it's a small industry and once it starts to get out, you vote with your feet. You know, I think that's going to be the biggest message. They do want you to come and work for you, as Kate said, and if you put a stop to it by saying we're not going to stand by and let that happen, yeah, it's a strong message. The other thing I would say is it's probably not going to be as overt when you're a clerk, but it might be things like some of my friends went to their sort of bonding Friday drinks was at strip clubs, and you say that that happened in the 90s, that happens like now. So be aware, and if you're a guy and just because you're being kind of, you know, taken under the wing of the male seniors, it doesn't mean you have to go along with them. I think it's a really powerful thing to not go if you're invited to a strip club. If it's not something that everyone can attend, then maybe just step out and say, no, I'd rather do something that's more inclusive, because no one wants to be left out. It's fine when you're in, but you don't want to be the one left out. So don't leave anyone out.
Can I just add to that? And I'm not recommending you charge up to this sort of senior elderly male partners and start haranguing them about this. But one of the things that has become really evident to me as I've gone around the world and engaged on these issues is the Me Too backlash. And the archetypal example of that is older male partners saying,
yeah,
I'm not going to mentor, saying or at least thinking, I'm not going to mentor younger female lawyers because of this Me Too movement. And at first my reaction was, don't be ridiculous. You know, don't sexually harass them, you don't have a problem. And then I thought, that is, although we disagree with it, a genuinely held belief that they have. And they're worried, there's been a lot of change. None of this was ever acceptable, but suddenly there's a lot of focus on these issues. And I think a lot of older members of the profession, mostly male, are genuinely worried. They don't know where the line is anymore. And so I think engaging in that conversation, and you know, again, I'm not saying you just start it right away. It's complex, and I know a lot of firms are trying to sort of set up reverse mentoring systems to enable this, but we need to educate and engage with those people, because if not, they'll just shut off and they'll keep mentoring the men, and you know, the slide we saw and the pyramid we want won't occur.
I might now open and ask the floor. I know there's quite a few questions on this feed, so if anyone's got any questions they just want to ask now, a bit of time.
My question was with regards to the regulatory bodies that we were talking about before. I'm obviously working for the Anti-Discrimination Board.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, with regards to the legal initiatives, is there a system in place where lawyers or whoever might need to go to them within the legal profession can go to them and raise a complaint, or is that not part of the legal
profession? Yes, that's a really good question. So if you look at it as professional conduct, solicitors have a rule, I think it's Rule 42, and barristers have a rule, it's Rule 123. So as I say to the barrister, it's not that hard to remember the rule. And that says that in the course of practice, a legal practitioner, be a barrister or solicitor, can't engage in sexual harassment, discrimination or workplace bullying. So the qualification is it has to be in the course of practice, and that has generally been interpreted quite broadly. So anything that you're doing or attending as a barrister, so like here, my professional conduct rules apply because I'm speaking to you in my professional capacity. So how do I do something about it? So the first port of call in terms of professional conduct is to contact the Office of the Legal Services Commissioner. So that's the sort of peak person who oversees professional conduct for all of the legal practitioners in New South Wales. The Legal Services Commissioner is now taking inquiries so that if you think, oh, look, I'm not sure if I've been sexually harassed, or I'm not sure I really want to make a complaint, or I'm not really sure what to do, or I just want to be able to tell somebody what's happened, then you can engage with the Legal Services Commissioner in that way. But if you say, look, this is pretty serious, I want some action to be taken, you can make a formal complaint. And the way in which that regulation works is the Legal Services Commissioner will then send it either to the Law Society if it's a solicitor, or to the Bar Association if it's a barrister. And then we have a form of self-regulation. So say for the Bar will then investigate that complaint with all of the procedural fairness for the person who's accused of the misconduct. And that will take a number of months to go through a professional conduct committee. And then a recommendation will be made. It will come to the Bar Council. The Bar Council will then make a decision about what to do. And if the complaint is an allegation of professional misconduct or serious unsatisfactory professional conduct, they can then refer it to the tribunal for a public hearing, and the tribunal's got a range of sanctions from striking somebody off to suspending them, to put conditions on their practicing certificate, a reprimand or the like. But if it's unsatisfactory professional conduct, the Bar Council, for example, can deal with the issue itself by suggesting some education or a reprimand or something of that kind. But once you've got that stain of a professional conduct finding against your name, you can go and have a look at the Legal Services Commissioner. He's got a list of all people who've been the subject of some sort of action. So that's sort of publicly available, so you can look that up. So that's the process. Some might say, well, what's in it for me? I'm the victim of sexual harassment. The professional conduct process is very much focused on the perpetrator, so what do I get out of it? Technically, the tribunal could make an order of compensation, but generally if someone was going to say, I want compensation because of the way I've been treated, they might go and see your mum at the Anti-Discrimination Board or the Human Rights Commission and follow a different path to get compensation for any loss that they've suffered as a result of it. So you make a good point. It's a very complex system to sort of work out where to go. But the Legal Services Commission at the present time is saying, right, let me see if I can simplify where you can go and how we might deal with it.
One more question.
Commission grapples with a lot of that external versus internal reporting mechanism. Where do you go? Do you go to the Anti-Discrimination Board? Or ultimately, I know that they would love to have that cultural change start from within. So to be able to go to your HR department, have it then kind of handled in house.
Yes.
But then the problem there is that you get the bumping of especially partners from firm to firm to firm, and they just keep offending again and again. Do you have a preference, or do you think that there's kind of an equilibrium that we need to have between that internal solution?
Well, it's sort of a fairly blunt approach to this now, and that is that there are now strict time limits for making complaints to the Human Rights Commission or the Anti-Discrimination Board. So you've got 6 months to go to the Human Rights Commission, and 12 months to the Anti-Discrimination Board. That's a whole other issue on the law reform on time limits. Yeah.
I reckon HR departments should be external, and there are some companies that run human resources for a bunch of different law firms. I would look up those law firms and say, that's great, that's a great example. But yeah, that way that there's, complaints are handled externally by a body that also represents other firms.
And a lot of firms are starting to disaggregate the HR function in this regard. So there's an inherent conflict of interest. If you report to HR, they are concerned about, hopefully, they're concerned about you and what you've experienced, but they're also concerned about the investigation, the reputational risk, the liability issue. And so some firms are splitting out and having contact officers who you can report to, and their only concern is supporting the target of the conduct, and then everything else is handled by HR. So I think we are moving in the right direction in that regard.
Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time, but I just wanted to say, first of all, that this event has been, at least hopefully, I speak for everyone, incredibly important. But also it's been really great to have you here and share your thoughts and your wisdom, and Kieran, for your work on the IBA report as well. So please, can you join me in thanking our guests tonight?